Thanks for joining us for Cultivated Audio, February 2026. Dairy co-ops like Kelowna Supernatural, Organic Valley, and Horizon Dairy can benefit the smaller dairy farmer and help keep standards for us where we want them when we're shopping for grass-fed and regeneratively produced dairy. First with us today is Phil Forbes, who's been connected to organics his entire 35-plus year career, and particularly in dairy, for the past 17 years. He is the Senior Director of Supply Chain for Kelowna Supernatural. And then we'll hear from FarmHer, Cindy Rover, and we'll speak about kefir and other ferments she makes from her farm in North Carolina. I'm Robin. Thanks for being here with us. Grab your earbuds and or a shovel, and let's dig in. Phil, as a testament to your expertise, share a brief history of your work experience before we move into all of this great info about dairy farming.
Sure. I've been involved, practicing, engaged with organic farming production for about, I'm going to say, close to 40 years. I started when I was fairly young, late teenage years, before organic farming was a thing.
Yes.
And I've kind of done almost everything. I was a farm manager for a medicinal herbal company. I managed their farm, grew medicinal herbs organically, which is very challenging to do. Managed and produced beef organically, raised cows, bison, had chickens on pasture. I've done an organic market garden. Just to give you an idea of the breadth of it,
yes,
I have
certainly
a perspective that's pretty wide. And then I've been involved in organic dairy for the last 20 years. I was a plant manager. I was the quality manager. And then finally, I moved over into the term is fieldman in the dairy industry. From fieldman grew to supply chain manager, director. And I am primarily engaged with the farmer. Everything that has to do with procuring milk, raw milk, for processing. So I always tell people, the knowledge in dairy is intense. It's exponential. There's so much to know about it to produce something that's going bad the minute it comes out of the cow. And I always say it's proof God exists, because if somebody actually drinks a glass of milk and says, oh, wow, that tastes pretty good, that's a miracle. Because you are milking a cow, you need to keep that milk under 40 degrees, above 32 degrees, throughout the entire chain, all the way to the customer, and the customer needs to get it to their refrigerator on time. Just unbelievable how many times it changes hands. And so I'm engaged with that all the time.
Yes,
it's
yes.
Always urgent. You get into a mode of just being used to that, how urgent it all is. And I've done that now for 20 years, and so here we are.
Yes, yes. How fortunate, really, to be able to be the fieldman and be part of that chain of events that takes you literally from the farm to the market and to the huge market.
Yes.
So I know you speak and have spoken to a lot of folks from conventional dairies about transitioning to organic, but I'd like to circle this conversation around moving from organic into regenerative, and then later we'll chat about going all in, leaving grain-fed out completely. And maybe, are they the same? Is that all part of the same process, or is that a whole different subject, really?
Yeah, let me talk to that a little bit, if you don't mind.
Please.
Organic dairy is much like conventional dairy. You're essentially feeding the same way for the most part. Except for in organic dairy, there is a pasture requirement. So that would be one of the big differences. To move from conventional to organic, you're going to have to set land aside for grass. Now, with organic dairy, we see a path, and we've seen farms become successful in regenerative ag dairy by first moving to 100% grass-fed, because that is a significant step that allows then for the regenerative step to be way more successful. So for a farm, let's say they're regular organic, they feed corn, they feed soybeans, they grow those usually. For them to move to 100% grass-fed is just a really big step. They can no longer use corn for energy. That's the big thing, not only in 100% grass-fed, but in regenerative. Where's your energy coming from? Corn has always been that for organic dairy and for sure conventional dairy. Well, corn actually is a grass. So you could feed corn to a 100% grass-fed dairy farm. You could feed that to the cows, but you can't feed it once it gets past a certain state. And I think it's the milky stage where the kernels are still not a viable grain yet, a viable seed. Mm-hmm. You could do that, but most of them don't. They don't grow corn to feed it as a grass, but you could. Mostly what these 100% grass-fed dairies will do to be successful, they need to start selecting their cows that look like they would be successful on grass only. A very large Holstein cow bred to do well on grain and produce a lot of milk will fail miserably on a 100% grass-fed farm. So you want a smaller cow. As you start to transition, there's actually a transition period from organic dairy to 100% grass-fed organic dairy. There's a transition period. And that's where you really need to be aware of how your cows are doing. The ones that are starting to get really thin, you need to probably sell those and maybe buy others that have been proven on grass-fed farms to come into your herd so that you can not drive the health of your herd down. Typically, the transition from organic dairy to 100% grass-fed, the farmer will do that because of price. A lot of times, the price is much higher, and the farmer sees an opportunity there. However, if the cows are not selected to do well on grass, the volume that the farmer gets in terms of milk will be so much lower that a lot of times, if they're not ready for this, they won't make any more money, bottom line money. They'll get a higher price, but they don't get enough milk. The farms that I have seen, and this is, I would say, applicable to regenerative dairy, is it's best to be a true believer. And what I mean by true believer is that you're going to be 100% grass-fed no matter what. Even if you're conventional, you would be 100% grass-fed because you believe in it. This is who you are. This is what you're doing. And so if you go that way, you will have educated yourself on the intricacies of quality pasture. That's crucial. Making very, very good hay and forage for the winter. You'll become very good at that. And you will have selected your cows to do well on grass. And so even with a very low conventional price, you'll make money. Then you move into 100% grass-fed organic dairy, and you're making a lot of money. You're getting a lot of milk out of your cows. Your cows are doing well on forage only. And if you can do that, then moving into regenerative is the same process. The ones that I've seen that have done well have seen the opportunity with regenerative dairy and have moved into that as true believers and are able then to make the adjustments necessary to go from 100% grass-fed organic to regenerative 100% grass-fed organic. Those farmers do the best. Right now, the pricing on regenerative dairy isn't quite the same as 100% grass-fed, but I will say this. I am seeing in the marketplace, there's a customer base that's starting to demand it, So we are trying to tell farmers now, start looking at this because the customer will require it. And if you want your farm to have a longevity, you'll want to start moving in that direction.
Yes, so you certainly are aware of what's out there. Let's look at organic farms. Say you have an organic farm, but they're not 100% grass dairying at the moment. What kind of cows do they have overall? Now, if you could give us a generic picture, what kind of cows do they have now, and what kinds have you seen be very successful with the grass-fed only?
Okay, so on regular organic farms, the predominant cow that's used is Holstein.
Okay.
Those are usually much larger, they give a lot of milk, and their components are lower. Components meaning butterfat, protein, other solids. That's how milk is priced. The incentive for farms on organic dairy farms, just straight organic, is volume.
Now, right, but you just said...
on 100% grass-fed farms...
Okay.
The cow that is predominant, at least initially, that I've seen, are Jerseys. The Jerseys are smaller. They are more efficient with forage, and they give a lot higher components. They'll have a very high butterfat, for example. So I would say that's the same for regenerative farms. They would want a smaller cow. Devon cows, Normandy is another one, Fleckby. These are all smaller cows that do well on grass, and Jersey being the most utilized cow for these types of farms.
Are they available to buy, to purchase?
So right now, we're in just a really strange situation across the United States. The beef herd is pretty small, so... Any cow is worth a lot of money. For example, three-day-old bull calves on a dairy usually have been almost valueless. I mean, you almost had to pay to get rid of them. Now those three-day-old bull calves are worth $1,000.
So is that the same for a Holstein or a Jersey?
It would be the same for a Jersey as well. If you were to buy breeding stock, let's say you're going to buy a Jersey cow, 100% grass-fed, proven 100% grass-fed, I bet you would pay $5,000, $6,000 for that cow. That is almost too high. That's probably too high for making money on that cow. Usually, cows have been priced historically around $2,000, $2,500. So that just tells you the beef herd across the United States is low. You know, you could sell cows to another dairyman, or you could sell those cows to the beef market and make maybe similar amount of money. It's insane right now.
Where do the A2 cows come into the picture, and how important is it moving forward?
Very important moving forward. A2 is that gene that folks have found that they're lactose intolerant, can't consume dairy. They have A2 milk, they can, which is very significant for consumers who are lactose intolerant, all of a sudden realize they have an option there. I know the dairy industry is moving towards A2, even like maybe 20 years ago, there was a company in Iowa that tried to really promote A2 and had A2 on the label, but failed miserably because people did not understand what A2 was and thought it was genetically modified.
Right.
Wouldn't buy it. Now A2, the consumer understands that and is growing rapidly. And I would say in the future that if you're not A2, you may not be able to sell your dairy product.
We've been speaking about the Holstein and the Jersey. Does every breed of cow have that A2 gene possibility? Or are there certain breeds that present it more?
Jersey cows tend to be more A2A2. However, with Holstein cows, you can get a A2A2 bull and over time convert your herd to A2A2. But generally speaking, if you were looking for A2A2 milk out on the market, I would say look first at Jersey milk if you can possibly obtain it.
Yes. So if you have Holstein versus Jersey, when you have those two, how long can you milk a Holstein and the amount of milk you get compared to how long a Jersey? I mean, I know Holsteins will give you more milk, but am I mistaken? Don't Jerseys give you longer time period? They're able to be milked for more years, or how does that work?
I think it's more a function of the type of production system those cows are in.
I see.
I do think Jerseys probably could last longer, generally speaking, but I think it's more a function of the production system. So in conventional dairy, they'll milk the cows, at least the big ones do, three times a day, and the cow lasts maybe 3-4 years. In an organic system, the ones that I have worked with, Holstein cows, Jersey cows have lasted, on average, 12 to 15 years. It's how they're cared for. It's what they're fed. And it's the fact that they're not just used as milking machines. You know, they might be milked twice a day, probably, but maybe sometimes once a day. It's a completely different approach. And so I've always been a real supporter and proponent of the organic system, even for animal welfare reasons.
Right.
Just because the cow is not pushed so hard to produce milk.
Right. That's something I want to talk about in a little bit. But first, let's take a journey with you. You go to a farm. You go and decide whether or not you're going to buy someone's milk for Kelowna or Horizon, perhaps. Do you look at the cows first before looking at or tasting or testing the milk? And if yes, what does the cow tell you? What are you looking for?
Okay. I have done that now for, like I said, 20 years, and I can almost tell immediately. And I just did this last week. You pull up to a new farm, and it's called curb appeal, road appeal. From the road, how does that farm look? I have seen farms that are pretty run down, very run down. And I've seen farms that probably you could have eaten your dinner off the road leading up to the house. it could be that stark. And ironically, the farm, and it's not always true, but mostly true, that if the farm looks really tidy and clean from the road, it's going to be very tidy and clean in the milk house. And the cows probably are going to be cared for very well. Now, it's not always true. So I will look closely at a lot of things. But if the farm looks good from the road, then I'll go look at the milk house. If the milk house is clean, that's a very good sign of the cleanliness of the milk, because it looks like the farmer is taking the time to pay attention to all the details. I will then go look at the cows. Two things to look for: how dirty is the cow, and what is the body condition score? A body condition score is a numerical system, 1 through 5, and 1 being very thin, 5 being very fat. I look for 2 to 3 on a body condition score, and you can tell right away how they look. If the cow is really dirty, that means that the cow is lying down in manure or something that is not conducive for the cleanliness of the facility. And there could be a lot of reasons for that, so I don't look with such strict eyes where I'm trying to hold everybody to an extremely high standard. I take in consideration that dairy farms are ongoing manufacturing facilities, and they have to treat the cow with, or should treat the cow, with a lot of respect, should do that. I take in consideration the farmer is dealing with so many factors, whether family issues, money issues, all those things. I take all of that in consideration. You can tell, though, after a while, after doing it a lot, you can tell almost immediately, just walking around, how that farm is going to be and how that farm is treating that cow. So with that, then I will ask for their quality statement. Every time a farm is picked up by a truck backs in, pumps the milk from the bulk tank onto the truck. There's a sample taken. That sample is sent to the lab. So the farm is being evaluated on quality all the time. It's constant, where you can look at an entire month, for example, and see each pickup, you know, what are the components, what is the bacteria levels. Bacteria level is a, they call it standard plate count. It's a indication of the cleanliness of the equipment, and then the cleanliness of the milk. Somatic cell is a indication of the stress on the cow. These are all indicators of quality. If you have low numbers on the quality scale, that's good. That's very good. So if the farm looks good from the road, if the cows are clean and look well fed, milk house is clean and the quality is good, oh, that's a farm to get. And usually the farmers are very proud of what they're doing. And I would say most farmers are anyway.
Sure.
Very proud of what they're doing. They like what they do. Some put more emphasis on certain things and others put emphasis on other things. But by and large, we look for those farms that look good. And I will be just real honest. It's really easy now for somebody to pull up, know a farm is shipping to a certain brand, take a picture and put it on Facebook. And all of a sudden, the brand now realizes, you know, the brand, if that farm doesn't look good, then people think the brand's bad. So we encourage farmers, you know, as best they can, to have that sort of curb appeal as much as possible.
Yes,
just
yeah.
For that situation as well, because perception in the marketplace is as important as reality.
Of course.
We are very aware of that.
Yeah, and what a new world it is for farmers. Farmers are being asked to be on video and audio. They're not just being farmers anymore, and they've got to show beautiful pictures of their farm and do a blog and do all these things. But something else, you know, when you talk about curb appeal, let's go deeper in, because obviously that's what regen is. It's not just, oh, your grass looks pretty, but how deep are the roots and what's your soil like? And we're not going to go into that piece today because I want to cover more about specific for dairy. Is it too generic to ask the question, what types of cover crops make a great nutritive difference for dairy? Or is it really totally per region?
So are you asking in terms of regenerative or just regular organic?
Well, I don't see what the difference would be. I mean, if you want a good cover crop for dairy, what types of cover crop would you use? I mean, is it different than for beef, or is it different than for lamb, or that sort of thing?
So I would differentiate that this way. Cover crops to me are crops used for operations that are growing crops. So let's say you're growing corn here in Iowa. And ironically, in the conventional world, a lot of the conventional corn growers will plant a rye cover crop for the winter. I just find it just classic. A lot of the conventional guys say, oh, the organic system, and who cares about that? But they're using an organic practice. The rye cover crop has good root system, grows very quickly in the late fall, and is a tremendous cover crop to hold soil. In a organic system, they'll use cover crops the same way, only they'll use them in rotation. So let's say you're growing corn, soybeans, and then you'll have a cover crop of oats along with alfalfa. Oats are a great cover crop to help an alfalfa seeding grow in the early spring. So you'll plant oats and alfalfa. You'll be able to harvest the oats probably in May. And then you have alfalfa that comes up through it and is established, and that oat crop helped it establish. So that's a great cover crop for 100% grass-fed farms or regenerative farms. They don't have cover crops. They have permanent pasture. I would say that the type of forage that 100% grass-fed farm would use would be nothing annual. They would use perennial plants like orchard grass.
Yes.
They would use alfalfa, clover, brome. There's some fescue. here in Iowa and the Midwest, those are the predominant types of plants that grow well and are very nutritious for the cows during the grazing season. Those are the best ones. They would use no annuals. They would use only perennials. And those are the ones that are desired. Now, in a regenerative situation, you don't pay as much attention to what folks would call weeds. However, since I have a medicinal herb background, I don't look at them as weeds. I look at them as just other types of plants that are growing, and I watch cows eat them.
Yes.
I'll watch the cow eat them, and I think, oh. So even that, so that's the difference between 100% grass-fed and regenerative. The regenerative farmer will not look at all these weed plants as weeds. They'll look at them and say, that's part of what's out there. I really want to encourage some of these perennials that the cow will do really well on, like orchard grass, like alfalfa, like clover. I want to encourage that, but I'm not going to stress because I have sourdough out there or echinacea, because the cow, I've watched the cow do it, they'll eat that if they need it.
Exactly.
Whereas
yes, they know.
On a 100% grass-fed farm, they'll stress over that. They'll say, we've got to get rid of those weeds.
Wow, that's surprising to me. I've had a few surprises here looking into the dairy business even before the interview, so this is great information. Now, I know various farmers and dairy farmers who, in their feeding, they have some supplement. Some love sea minerals for the dairy, or some love using apple cider vinegar. Those are two that come to mind for me. Do you have experience with folks using that? Does it help with the protein or the vitamins in the actual milk? And are there other feed supplements that you've seen help and make a difference?
Yeah, I've seen molasses used. That's helpful. The apple cider vinegar is just for overall health, and I've seen that work. I've seen that work in humans as well.
Sure, yes.
The cow seems to do really well with that. That is a good example of the mentality as you progress along into these various approaches. The regenerative farmer, and I would say, you know, even the organic farmer and the 100% grass-fed farmer, as you progress, you don't look at immediate fixes. You try to look at overall health. So you're not giving antibiotics just because the cow's sick, because you have that cow being pushed to the max, milking it three times a day. Don't do that. You try to provide an atmosphere where it's clean, where the cow is not stressed, not milked too many times. It has access to the outdoors. And so apple cider vinegar, the great something that's put in the water to help the cow's just overall health, molasses. And you can always tell, because if the cow goes and actually licks the molasses, that means they want it. They need it.
Right.
And minerals, this is another approach that I've seen for the more progressive farmers. They won't give an overall just a mineral mix. They won't give a mineral mix. They'll give individual minerals. The cow knows. It's crazy how the cow knows. The cow will go select what she needs.
Obviously, you know, in the winter, all the cows can't be out on the pasture, but they've got hay that has been taken from the pasture. And I've heard you in the past mention baleage. Now, this is fermented, right? And what does that fermentation property hold for the dairy cow?
There's two things to that. There's two components. Now, I've seen the climate change in the Midwest over the last 30 years quite substantially. However, it's still true where the challenge to the farmer is to make quality feed with the right window of weather. So we will get, you know, rainstorms here in Iowa, as an example. They'll just pop up. And, you know, we all watch the weather pretty closely. We're aware of the Canadian air hitting the Gulf air, meets over Iowa, creates thunderstorms. If you're going to make quality forage, the forage needs to be cut at the right time, dried in the field, and baled before it gets rained on. Very hard to do in the spring. Very hard. So the I don't know if technology is the right word or the approach is maybe the right word. Baleage is a way to preserve forage in the spring and maybe through the summer. This depends on how the summer rolls out, where you can cut the field. Let's say you're cutting alfalfa or you're cutting grass. You'll let it dry in the field, and you might bale it that night, or you might bale it in the morning of the next day. So it gives you a very quick window to make quality forage, so that forage will ferment. But it's kind of like us. There's a lot of, in my opinion, a lot of health benefits to eating cultured food. For instance, kefir or kombucha or sauerkraut. Or anything that can be cultured helps your gut. Same with the cow. So you're now having some sort of cultured forage that was preserved. You're preserving the nutrients very quickly. It holds its quality throughout the summer and into the winter. You can feed it in the winter, and you've captured the nutritional benefits of that field and that forage. And you did it in Iowa in the spring. So that's one of the main reasons. When I say baleage, it's hay that's rolled up as a bale in some form, but it's rolled up while it is still kind of wet. And if you do it the right way, it will preserve. If you do it the wrong way, it will burn up.
Right,
yes.
It
will become too hot and burn up. So
another thing that you can tell by going to the farm, and this could perhaps help the novice dairy farmer or someone who's maybe just getting a cow, when you see manure out in the field, when do you look at it and go, oh my gosh, this is a sick cow? How can you tell by looking at that about the health of a cow?
Sure. Actually, it's not hard, and can be various reasons for it. If you see really loose stool out of a cow, it could be two things or a couple things. Number one, you could have scared that cow pretty bad, and it just, you know, eliminates. It comes out in the stream. A healthy cow pat is what is exactly that. It's a big pat. It falls on the ground. It's not loose, and it doesn't splatter. It comes down, you know, in a round shape. I'm going to say not green, but if they're on grass, it's going to be green.
Yes, yes, of
greenish.
Course.
But here's an indication of how biologically active your soil is, especially in the Midwest, is I've sat and watched cow pat. That cow just eliminated, had a cow pat. I'll sit there, I know it's strange to say, however, I will sit there and watch that cow pat. If you see dung beetles on top of that pat fairly quickly, could be within 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes, you have a very biologically active soil there,
right.
And those dung beetles will,
yes,
break that cow pat down very quickly and turn it into humus, topsoil. That's what's great about it.
Sure.
So anyway, that is something a novice could go look at. If they see loose stools, that's probably less good. If they see something that's more firm, that's better.
Right, sure. And then, Phil, let's talk about the processing. I've seen talks where they like to talk minimal processing and then also pasteurization or homogenization. Is that what the minimal processing is about? Is there any other kind of processing that happens to milk once it leaves the farm beside that?
Minimal processing to me is two things. Number one, you don't homogenize. When homogenization happens, the fat is changed.
Right.
So the fat doesn't rise to the top. It's soluble. That is overprocessing. That's my opinion and definition, number one. And number two is the pasteurization process is done at the lowest temperature you're allowed to do legally.
Which is what?
So you're not cooking that milk.
Right. Which is that temperature? What is that temperature?
145 degrees.
Okay.
So if you can get close to that, that's minimal processing, in my opinion. But most of the milks that are out there are processed at least 210 degrees.
Right.
Nothing's left alive.
Yeah, I always, when I'm making yogurt, I keep it low.
Yeah.
Is there a difference, do you think, in the nutritive value, either protein levels or vitamin levels and whatever else is involved, between a raw milk and one that's been processed but at a low temperature? Does the fat change in that process at all, or do you see the values go up or down very much, or if at all?
Yeah. So if you're a raw milk drinker, and let's say you're drinking Jersey milk, typically you would get very high butter fat. You would get a protein amount, whatever that would be, but the claim to fame for Jerseys is high butter fat. So if you're drinking raw milk, you're getting everything that milk has. If you are drinking, let's say 2%, immediately, well, the butter fat's 2%. So if you were drinking raw milk off of Jersey herd and it's 5%, you're getting 5% butter fat, which personally I think is amazing. If you're drinking 2%, for whatever reason, you're only getting 2%. And I can tell you this, by law, if you're cutting the fat off of a product, let's say 2% or 1%, or skim, if you've cut the fat, you have to add back vitamin A, telling me that there's a lot of nutritional value in the fat. So people just need to know that when they have reduced fat dairy, thinking, and I don't know if this is true, could be true, thinking that less fat is good because it won't make you fat. I think that's wrong. However,
totally.
Know when you have those things, we have to add vitamins back to hit a certain standard set by the FDA versus, let's say, raw milk. If you're a proponent of that, you're going to get all of that. Yeah. Everything that's in there, you're going to get. So,
and it doesn't shift like with, you know, you're getting organic milk from the store. And I don't know if there's any other state beside California that allows raw milk being sold in the store. But is there a difference if you have full fat raw milk or full fat low processed milk? Even if it's low?
No.
Okay, cool.
No. So for whole milk, usually, and I think almost always, whole milk is whole milk, by definition, by the FDA, 3.25% fat. So processors will process the milk so that there's 3.25% fat in the whole milk, per definition.
Got it.
So if you go to a farm and buy raw milk, you're going to get whatever, like I said, whatever fat it is. And if it's a Jersey herd, it's high fat. You'll get it.
Perfect. Thank you for answering that. Yeah. So are dairy co-ops like Kelowna, Organic Valley, and Horizon a necessity for the small dairy these days? And then separately, can you give the parameters of what would be considered a small or a large dairy?
Yes. I think that those three that you just mentioned are real proponents of supporting a small farm.
Yeah.
They really do honestly pick up and will engage with and spend the money. You're spending money to support a small farm. It's way more logistically efficient to back your tanker up and load a tanker on one farm. Way less costly. To pick up a bunch of small farms is way more costly. The driver has to drive farther. He has to get out of the truck 15 times to get a load. So Kelowna does this. I know Horizon does this. And I know Organic Valley does this. The smallest farm they'll pick up typically is Nomishman hen milking 10 cows. So Kelowna has those farms. That's pretty small.
So the small dairy farm, what would they do? I mean, if they had raw dairy customers, then great. But if they don't have enough, then these organizations, these co-ops, really are a key component.
Yeah. I would say so. Mm-hmm. They are giving an opportunity for some of these real small farms to have a market.
Right.
Let's say you're hand milking 10 cows. A lot of those guys will just sell raw milk off the farm. Depends on what state you're in.
Of course.
And the laws that they have. However, if they're in a state that doesn't allow it, co-ops, like you mentioned, give them an opportunity. I guarantee you, on the conventional side, nobody would take the time.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're not even considering
this. No way.
Yeah. So is it feasible for a large or huge dairy to be all grass-fed?
I think it is. Depends on where they're at and how the farm is set up. You know, there's a lot of questions about that. Let's say you're in Texas and you have your, and you're on the eastern side of Texas. Could be on the western side, but you have to have irrigation and you'd have to pump water. You have your farm, and I'm using Texas as an example, other places.
Sure.
You have your milking facility in the middle. You have to have it in the middle. You can't be on the side. The cow will only walk. It's not going to walk 10 miles to pasture.
Right.
So it's got to be in the middle and spoked out, and I think those are the most efficient. For 100% grass-fed, I question anything over 1,500 cows, maybe 2,000, maybe. Have to be a lot of pasture, a lot of land, set up really well, good lanes. And then
sure.
I would probably go with that. But I would say some of the best ones, the bigger ones, are milking between 500 and 1,000. There's not
gotcha.
A lot of those.
Gotcha. And then I think we would both agree, certainly, that the regenerative movement is a great move in a great direction. Are there any trends you can see that might come to mind right now that might end up going in a wrong direction?
The biggest thing, and this what the organic label faced initially, is that people were calling themselves organic and they really weren't.
Right.
Where I see the regenerative going that could be negative is that you just get anybody saying, yeah, we're regenerative. I see it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're regenerative. And I always say, what does that mean to you?
Good.
What is that?
Once
anytime,
again.
It just means they're just saying it.
Right. So once again, know your farmer, know your rancher whenever possible.
Correct.
And Phil, you
That's
travel
right.
to so many farms. What's the favorite part of your job beside, I'm sure, getting back home again?
The favorite part of my job is meeting the family. I love to go to a family farm, meet the farmer and the family, see what they're doing, see how it is supporting how they want to live their life. I feel like I'm really helping that, or I'm
yes.
part of helping that.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of my favorite parts.
Beautiful. And is there any advice that comes to mind shared from a dairy farmer to you?
I think some of the best wisdom that was shared to me early on was that the difficulty in making a living at dairy farming, so give us a break, Phil. And I really took that to heart. I've trained with regulators to inspect farms. It's not hard to walk onto a farm, stand there long enough, and start finding fault.
Right.
I really stopped myself from doing that. I really resonate with what they're trying to do, and I feel like I'm there to help them, not hinder them.
Nice. Without going against regulations and things like that.
Correct.
Yeah, beautiful.
That's right.
That's great. So what is your favorite dairy product? I always ask beef ranchers what their favorite cut of meat is, but I'm going to ask you, what's your favorite dairy product?
Kefir. I love it.
Good stuff, yeah.
Love it. Yeah.
And since you were a medicinal herbalist, I really want to ask you, and maybe a sentence about why, but what's an herb you just don't ever want to be without?
Well, this is bad to say. This is, everyone's going to just roll their eyes. I am a real proponent of anything that enhances the immune system. So I love echinacea, all the echinaceas, and anything that is immune system boosting, I'm a fan of.
Lovely. You know, I did a class with Dr. Christopher. You might be familiar with.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was amazing. And his favorite herb was lobelia. So I always liked to know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you just found out how old I am. Well, Phil, thank you so much for sharing, and it must be so satisfying and frustrating, I'm sure, at times, but I certainly see what you're doing as a great service, and thank you for sharing all of that with us today.
Yes, thank you very much.
Cindy, tell us about New Pasture Farm, where you are, your livestock.
I am in North Carolina in the Triad Triangle area. I serve many families across that whole region. I have all kinds of different cows, from Jersey to Red Devons, a couple Guernsey, but they're all genetically tested for A2A2. So that's something that's important for us and for, I think, everyone's health. I produce raw milk for humans and a herd share. And I also produce raw milk for pets and pet use under North Carolina law. As you know, raw milk is legal in some states and it's illegal in other states. And in North Carolina, we are able to operate under two exemptions, nice, which is a herd share and also labeling our milk as pet use under a pet license.
And then do you grow the veggies that you make ferments out of?
I do not grow any vegetables. I use local. I have a company called K Culture Ferments.
Cindy, I love that you literally dreamt up your K Culture business. Tell us about that.
Yes, love that. Was amazing. First, I was a homesteader. I was a mom looking for food. There wasn't any. back, I don't know, 25 years ago, you know, I went and got a goat and put it in my minivan and drove for 5 hours with it over a tarp. So that was my start on raw milk. Eventually went from figuring that all out to serving other people with it. So I was doing that. I was doing grass-fed meats, bone broth, all of the nourishing traditions type food. When we started farming for other people, there wasn't GMO-free feed. There wasn't organic feed anywhere in this area. We used to go get organic apples so we could bring them to people in Greensboro because they didn't even have a way to get organic apples back in a driveway we did a market in. I needed to fund the farm. I fermented for my family. I fermented for some customers. I don't know. I had a dream one day. I was taking a nap and I was in that moment of between asleep and awake, and I wasn't awake yet, but I just saw a fermenting company. I heard this name, K Culture Ferments, and the K's really were kefir, kombucha, kraut, kimchi, kvass, and I had been making kvass for a lot of years. I had made sauerkrauts off and on. I just knew in my heart I was going to have this business. And I remember thinking, how is this going to happen? And I heard, you're going to learn from the best. And I just believed it. If I was around someone who made it well, I would just learn how to make it well with them. There was a friend of mine who made amazing sauerkraut and wanted to sell their business. When I heard she was selling, I didn't think too much about it. And one day I was driving and I was about to put an application in for Publix for my beet kvass. And I just had this feeling in my tummy to stop and pull over and call her about her business. She said, huh, this is so weird. It is for sale. Somebody was in line to buy it, but their contract for buying it runs out. I'm going to put you in line and give you a week or two to think about it. And it was literally that fast. I ended up being able to buy so much of her equipment, and she was able to teach me how to ferment like a beast. I mean, she was amazing.
I love that.
So I was able to bring that to life, bring that into this business and this application that I was doing. And that's a long story, but
it's a great part of
serving this idea that's been bubbling in my family for just so long, you know, 25 years.
Right.
I'm still doing it.
Yes, you're well established and fermenting like a beast. I love that. Well, I would like to speak to you about the fermented milk, about the kefir. The guest that was on before you, Phil Forbes, that was his favorite dairy product. So I thought, oh, how great. Let's find Cindy Rover. So how did kefir catch your attention to start making it?
Well, it's just kind of always been a part of my education about real food, nourishing foods. I learned how to make kefir early on. You know, we would just share grains back in the day. I needed it for my children. When I started with raw milk, I had two sons that were in need. One could not have any formula. I didn't have enough milk to produce myself. And I also had another son who we were in the process of adopting, and he had a lot of dietary needs. He had autism. He had a seizure disorder. And so being such a young parent, I didn't know what I didn't know, and I didn't know what I needed. But that path just led me into it being the food and giving this milk to my son. He was a baby.
Yes.
And then giving it to my other son, that was the turnaround, right? He was on medication for his seizures, and he was having them weekly, 2, 3, 4 in a week. 8 months into having him with us and changing some of those things, he was verbal. He was nonverbal when we got him, except for maybe 4 sentences. Outside, ball, no. always
yes.
No. But he just turned around, and it was just more sentences and just more awareness, and the seizure medication just kept him down on energy and focus, and the seizures went down to, I think we ended up maybe 1 every few months.
Oh,
so that was my big, I'm not moving from this place, right?
Right, yes. So no, that's
I just started
Cindy.
Going there. The kefir was so integral to that.
Yes. Well, tell us about making the kefir. And of course, kefir grains are the starting point right there, along with the raw dairy, the good raw dairy, of course. You said you started exchanging grains with friends. Is that how it got rolling? And
well, you know, you just get grains from each other. Somebody gave me grains. I would make them. I would leave them too long. It was just kind of off and on until I really decided this is a source of protein. This is what I need to be doing. Just for us, it cleared up my husband's eczema. So when we're making it, the little SCOBYs, they don't take much care, so you can just do a continuation of kefir. Mm-hmm. Over the years, I've got some hacks I can share with you.
Please do, yes.
But one of the things is, so they're little SCOBYs. They call them grains, which confuses a lot of customers when
sure.
we talk about grains.
Mm-hmm.
They think, oh, I'm grain-free. I don't want any grains. They're referred to everywhere as kefir grains, but there's no corn or barley or wheat in them. They're little SCOBYs. They're much like kombucha SCOBYs in a way, but they don't look the same, right?
Right.
They're kind
yes.
of smushy. They don't break apart. And they make babies, right? We put them in the milk, and then we ferment for 24 hours. Sometimes it's a little less if it's warm. Sometimes it's a little more if it's cooler. But it's around 24 hours. If your grains are healthy, they're going to always make more grains. If you keep making the kefir with more and more and more grains, you'll find out that your kefir will just start making too fast. It'll over-ferment. It will start to separate. It'll get funky, tasting, you know, a little too sour. So then that's a signal to take out some of the grains and kind of start over, maybe remeasure. It's usually a tablespoon-ish per quart. So what I like to do, especially when it was just me and I wasn't making it for other people, right? I would get behind. I was mom, you know, all over the place. And I would forget and let it over ferment. And that was one of the most frustrating things that I think about making ferment, the timing. So I have a little trick where when it's done, I'll just put it directly in the fridge. I won't pour it off. I'll just put it directly in the fridge and then pour it off when I get to it, which is could be the next day or the day after. And then that helps me slow down. If you start thinking you need to make it every 24 hours, you might think oh my gosh, I don't drink that much kefir. I don't need that much kefir, right?
Right. Yes.
So if you put it away when it's done fermenting without pouring it off, it gives you a couple days and it slows down getting so much kefir out of the,
yes,
the process.
Yes, good point. Yeah. Yes.
So that's my favorite thing I learned how to do. So I'm happy to tell the world.
Yes. Yeah. So if you need more grains, it sounds like you've got buddies around the area, but is there a place where you can buy grains that you're aware of, or is it just something you seek out?
Yeah, there is a company, Cultures for Health. They're in Raleigh. They will send out dried kefir grains.
Nice.
Is one source. And you just kind of wake them up. You're going to go ahead and make your kefir and then be ready to not save that batch, right? You just let them get used to the milk source that you're going to use.
Oh, interesting.
It's not a failure when it doesn't come out. Even if you have grains that you're storing in your fridge, when you go to wake those up, or you get grains from someone else that's maybe using it with their raw milk or with store-bought milk or whatever their source is, or if it's a dehydrated version from Cultures for Health, you're going to have a wake-up process. It's just good to know that you're not going to save that batch. You can give it to your pets, you can do whatever, but it's not going to be that enjoyable, right? But then you do it again, and then you get going on your...
Oh, I never knew that about kefir. That's a great hit. So with your trials and tribulations all these years, and now you're quite established at this, is there anything else that comes to mind on what you should be wary of or be careful about?
Yeah, I hear all the time, I can't ferment because I failed. And failing is part of fermentation. That's how you get good at it. You just see what works, see what doesn't, and you just keep doing it over and over. So I always tell them, you're not good at fermenting. You're not good at failing. You think I shouldn't fail. And then so I usually turn that around with them, and that's always a fun moment. But a couple of things. I just use a paper towel over it with a rubber band around the jar lid. Mm. And there's this pretty thick part of it. I'll just pinch that off and throw it out because I don't like the flavor of that where the air was touching. Mm. So that's one thing. If it just tastes funky, you don't like it, just take that little piece off and just give it to a pet. Just let it go or compost it, right?
Right.
And then if your grains are just sad, they're not growing, they're not making babies, they're always staying the same size, I would give them a break and pour some cream in a jar and just let them either ferment with that or put them in the fridge and just let them snack on that for a good week and then pour that off and then make your kefir again.
Yeah.
I read that somewhere or I heard that somewhere that they love cream and they just need something in it sometimes if they're tired, and it's worked. So I think that's all my wisdom.
Oh, well, hardly, I'm sure, but thank you for that. Yeah, the way you've talked about failure, that's a message from everyone I've spoken to over these 7 years of doing cultivated audio. It's like that's where we're going to learn our best lessons, is trying something. So it's not a failure. We've got to come up with that better word, right?
I agree. I see it with farmers. I see it with fermenters. People, moms, they just think, well, I can't feed my family this way, or I can't farm, or I can't ferment. And really, it's just, we can. And I just would love to see people get through those barriers, because that's how we're going to have,
yes,
a food system. People who aren't afraid that failure meant something, and that's how you're learning, right? That's how
yes.
we get these skills and
yeah.
each other, right? I have learned everything I've done. I learned from someone else. I would go be with the person, watch them, then they would watch me do it. Then I would just take that skill and start doing it.
Yeah, that's such another
yeah.
great way that regenerative agriculture is really growing community.
I think it's the only way.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful, Cindy. Thank you. I know K-Culture fermented veggies are a specialty for sure of yours. Do you have a favorite variety or blend that you make, or is there one that you find to be most popular with your customers?
Yes, they're all my favorite. They're like my children. They're all my favorite. But the most popular selling is our red kimchi. By far, it just outsells everything. I do kind of switch out.
Sure.
I just get a favorite for a little while, and then I go to the next one. That's why I love the variety. I love that we have 8 flavors. And I don't know how people eat without these 8 flavors. I'm like, what are people eating out there? There's so much kraut sitting here. But I think my favorite right now is my curry kraut. It's called trifecta kraut. And I take all the curry spices you can imagine, and I grind them up fresh, and then I ferment it with some seaweed. And I take my bone broth. It's my new favorite thing. I take the bone broth, I heat it up, and then I plop in 2 big plops of my trifecta sauerkraut, and it makes chicken noodle soup. It tastes like I made soup all day long. It's just so yummy.
Great combo.
You can add chicken into it. You can add the noodles into it. But the little bit of sour and all those curry spices, I'll use it to break a fast. I'll use it to keep fasting. I'll use it just to give my tummy, my gut flora, variety. Our biome needs variety in our food. And all those spices count. So that's my favorite now.
Is there anything you'd like to say to wrap up?
Allow yourself to get a few batches in. Once it's consistent, it's safe. And you can always check the pH. Then you can start to trust the process a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. And then what would the pH be then?
Well, for milk kefir, I guess I've never done that, but I'm sure you can. But I do with the fermented vegetables.
Right. Okay.
I always do. And it should be less than 4.
Yes.
Less than 4, and you're good to go. And then once you know, so you just check it till you learn, and then you don't have to check it. We don't have to be scientists, right?
Yes.
We're just feeding our families.
Some great information, advice, and inspiration to join the regenerative movement. Many thanks to Phil Forbes and Cindy Rover for anything we do here. It's cultivatedaudio.com, and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make here where we all want to be.